Kentucky lawmakers have ended this year's legislative session voting to override Governor Andy Beshear's vetoes on a range of laws. Meanwhile, lawmakers in Ohio and Indiana are working to craft state budgets as they consider legislation focused on property tax relief. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We'll be talking about regional politics for the full hour today. Joining me now are Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman, and Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Welcome back, everybody.
Glad to be here.
Always happy to be here.
Well, we're always grateful to have your time and expertise. Sylvia, as I mentioned, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear vetoed a bunch of bills state lawmakers passed during the legislative session. Here he is discussing one of them.
We love and we accept everyone. This bill isn't about love. House Bill 4 is about hate.
Sylvia, was there a common thread that ran through his comments about these vetoes he made?
Well, I would say he vetoed a pretty wide swath of bills this year. The one he was just talking about, House Bill 4, is about diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in higher education that passed this year. And, you know, he also vetoed bills that he said, infringed on his powers as governor, violated the separation of powers, which is obviously a big topic in the state always and nationally right now. He vetoed bills that had to do with how we define water in the state, water that we can regulate for pollution, bills that would change the language around abortion, the abortion ban in the state. I mean, really a wide swath of bills. But I would say one of the main streams that ran through was kind of Beshear asserting his values as governor, as a Democratic governor in a red state. And so that was kind of one of the main themes that I noted. And before we go any further, I think it's really important to note that basically all of Beshear's vetoes were overridden by the legislature this year.
Okay. I appreciate that clarification. So among the bills that Republican state lawmakers voted to override, they were a couple of these laws related to higher education. You just mentioned House Bill 4 that bans diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. There was another one related to employment contracts. Explain a little bit more about those laws to us.
Sure. So the bill that you just mentioned, the employment contracts, higher education advocates, faculty members have called that an anti-tenure bill. The lawmaker who proposed it, Representative James Tipton, he says that it is not aimed at faculty members with tenure. However, it does include them. And basically what it says is that all faculty members have to go through a review every few years, and that review, the end result of that review can be used as cause to fire any faculty member, including tenured faculty. So, faculty members who are tenured, who aren't tenured, maybe who are working towards that, say that it is an attack on that institution and that it, for example, the bill does not lay out what kind of criteria that the has to be used in these evaluations. They could really be on anything, which faculty members are concerned about. That process is run by boards versus the president of the institution or direct supervisors. So, and those boards are chosen by the governor. They're political appointees. So, there's concerns that it invites a political interest into the equation. So that's one bill that the governor tried to veto and that the legislature overrode. And then back to House Bill 4, that anti-DEI bill, that was really very contentious. It does a lot of things. It's quite a large bill. But the bottom line is that it would ban all diversity, equity, and inclusion offices, officers, initiatives, required trainings, any required courses that have the DEI concepts in them. It also bans bias investigations, investigations into professor-faculty bias. It also bans licensure boards. That's kind of away from the higher education realm, but it bans licensure boards from requiring those DEI trainings. So it does a lot of things.
And we just heard a little bit about what Governor Beshear said about why he vetoed House Bill 4, that DEI or anti-DEI bill. What did state lawmakers say about why this, they thought this law was needed, the Republicans who backed this law. Why did they say House Bill 4 was important, was necessary in the state?
Well, lawmakers argue that the term DEI is misleading, that the idea that it's about diversity, equity, inclusion isn't how it's being implemented, and that DEI practices are unfair, that they help some students over others, and that they're discriminatory. So they've been basing kind of their legal argument behind House Bill 4, saying that it is required by the recent Supreme Court decision that overturned affirmative action in college admissions. Now, of course, this bill goes far beyond college admissions. It is included in there, but it goes far beyond that. And so lawmakers say that this is necessary, like it's a necessary evolution beyond that Supreme Court hearing, Supreme Court decision. Democratic lawmakers have stood really firmly against House Bill 4, saying that DEI is not discriminatory, that it's about recognizing differences between people and helping those who have historically been left out of these institutions to help them gain a foothold that has historically been denied them.
Karen, these laws in Kentucky sound a bit like a piece of legislation in Ohio that Governor Mike DeWine just signed into law. Here's Mel Searle with the Ohio Student Association discussing Ohio Senate Bill 1.
This bill isn't the end of anything. It's the beginning of more work to be done to protect our education and students. What that looks like going forward, I myself am not sure. That is above my pay grade.
Karen, tell us about this law that the governor just signed.
Yeah, you're talking about Senate Bill 1, which after listening to the description of the other law in Kentucky, it doesn't have nearly the specifics that one does. It's more of a broader scope, I guess. It's specifically aimed at what Republicans say is liberal indoctrination at public colleges and universities. And so this is only to public colleges. And it bans most diversity, equity, and inclusion, the mandatory training. It bans faculty strikes. It requires a civics course that's focused on American history and free market capitalism. It requires post-tenure performance reviews. Those are just a few of the things that it does. And if it sounds familiar, it's because last session there was a very similar bill that passed the Senate, but it did not pass the House. That's Senate Bill 83. The House Speaker, the former House Speaker, Jason Stevens, had said it didn't have the votes to pass in the House last time. Well, it did pass this time. He was one of the no votes. The House is a little bit different than when he was Speaker, but that was always a contention that he was blocking it, and he said he wasn't. But now that the bill has been signed by Governor Mike DeWine, and he wasted no time in signing it. It was about 48 hours from the time he got it. He said he was going to look at it and consider it, but he signed it very quickly, comparatively. Now the shift is to the opponents of it. You've got student groups, like you just heard from one of the students. You have faculty groups. You have union groups that are very concerned. And so there are some talks going on what they're going to do in terms of legal action or other moves to try to block what they say is a law that's going to destroy public education in Ohio.
What kind of
option?
Go ahead, Sylvia.
Sorry, just let me jump in really quickly. This is also just for public colleges and universities in Kentucky. I just wanted to make that clear. This House Bill 4 also only applies to public universities in Kentucky.
Thank you. So, Karen, what kind of legal options do opponents of Senate Bill 1 that's now the governor has signed it into law, what kind of legal options do they have?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not really entirely sure, but certainly there are people above my pay grade, including the American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio and some of the lawyers there who are looking into these things, I'm sure, as well as, like I said, unions. And that's a big deal in Ohio because in 2011, there was an effort to restrict collective bargaining rights for public sector unions, police officers, firefighters, teachers. When it passed, unions were furious. They mounted what became a record campaign to get signatures to put that before voters, and they actually repealed that. That was Senate Bill 5 in 2011. There are some questions about whether we might see something similar to that. Union power has diluted a bit since 2011 in Ohio, but unions still feel that they are very concerned about this. They've called it the most significant attack on organized labor since then. And they feel that an attack on one, being an attack on faculty at public universities is an attack on all unionized groups. So I think that's where a lot of us are looking to see if there's going to be any action, though court action is certainly a possibility. It's pretty common in Ohio anymore when there's a controversial piece of legislation that there's a court challenge over it.
We're talking about regional politics for the full hour today. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Brandon, Indiana lawmakers have been talking about a DEI ban there too, right? Explain what they've been talking about.
Yeah, it's actually a mix, it sounds like, of the Kentucky bill. So the public colleges and universities part about in Kentucky attacking tenure and basically making it so that any professor can be fired after this regular review that goes on. That happened last year in Indiana. That bill has already become law for over a year now, or for about a year now. This year, they're going after sort of the rest of what Sylvia described in the Kentucky bill, which is addressing DEI in government and education specifically. Now, the bill started out really, really broad in that it said that, for instance, no government agency could have a position on anti-racism, among a laundry list of other terms. The bill was significantly pared down to get rid of DEI offices and officers, to ban sort of DEI training in government. In schools, it will now, again, has kind of a laundry list of terms, and any training or curriculum that any school has about things like bias and racism, and et cetera, it would now have to post all of that material, the training material, the curricular material, online, which teachers and schools say is ridiculously costly, that all of their sort of, you know, books and stuff, the books that they teach in class, they're already posted online. This would add significantly more requirements on teachers specifically. So it doesn't go nearly as far. The bill used to affect anyone who had a government contract and their ability to offer certain workplace trainings that lawmakers deemed were anything to do with DEI. But that was taken out of the bill. We haven't seen the bill come up in the second half of session. It passed the Senate. It has not resurfaced in the House, although there is about a week left of committee time, and I would expect to see it next week. But then again, maybe the House decided it just wasn't worth doing.
And it sounds like, Brandon, in Indiana, is this aimed at higher education or does this look at K-12 education also?
No, this year's bill is aimed squarely at K-12 education. Okay. It also ties in public colleges and universities in terms of some of the trainings and stuff that you're not allowed to do anymore, that you wouldn't be allowed to do anymore. But they did a lot in that space last year with higher ed. And this year it's aimed at all local government units, state and local, and schools, K-12 schools.
Can I add one thing here real quick? Now that this bill has passed, Senate Bill 1 in Ohio has passed on public colleges, now there is another bill that kind of hits some of these same things that's aimed at K-12 schools. It doesn't require a ban on faculty strikes, but it does do a lot of the same things like you're just hearing about. These are bills that are being talked about in Republican states because this is a big Republican talking point. The idea that diversity, equity, and inclusion has not worked the way it was intended and it needs to go away.
Well, we will be back with our regional politics show after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about regional politics for the full hour today. My guests are Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman, Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith, and Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Brandon, I know this is a budget year in Indiana. Where do budget negotiations stand in the Indiana State House? What's the deadline for getting a budget passed?
So where we stand right now in negotiations is next week we will see the Senate Republican budget proposal. We saw the House about a month ago, and the Senate has been taking hearings, and then a lot of backroom negotiations are now going on. And we will see their budget proposal next week. They will pass that the week after, and then it will go into the final stages. We will also get an updated revenue forecast in mid-April, and that's going to be really important because that will give lawmakers the sort of final number that they can shoot for in terms of new revenue in the next 2-year budget cycle that they're writing right now. It's also going to be critically important this year because the revenue forecast that they're working off of right now, which came in December, was not great for Indiana. It had about $800 million of new money to spend in the first year of the budget, but basically no new money in the second year, something like $70 million, which is, a tiny percentage of what they actually need. And it would be more than eaten up by just the projected need for Medicaid spending in the state of Indiana. So that updated forecast is going to be really important because any extra money that they are projected to have, they will definitely want to use. It could also have an impact on what goes into the final budget in terms of new revenue sources. So Indiana has been debating an expansion into online gaming. So we have online sports gaming, but you can't play like table games, poker, roulette, et cetera, legally in the state of Indiana. Well, there was a bill that would have allowed that, as well as online lottery. That didn't really go anywhere, but it could also always resurface in the budget if lawmakers feel like they want the money that it will generate. There's also talk about raising the state's cigarette tax, which hasn't been done in well over a decade, potentially raising the state's alcohol tax, which I think hasn't happened since the 70s. Anything that, they're not going to raise the sales tax, they're not going to raise the income tax, the sort of major revenue sources, but things like the cigarette tax, alcohol, gaming taxes are things that their voters are a little more comfortable with. And so those could be on the table if those revenue numbers are as pessimistic as some worry they might be.
And Brandon, how do state lawmakers' budget priorities compare to Governor Mike Braun's proposal, the budget he put forward?
There's a lot of crossover there. The House Republican budget really copied a lot of what Braun was proposing. And then Braun was also proposing things like a few sales tax holidays and a tax cut that lawmakers just don't think we have money for this year. That they aren't opposed to the ideas, certainly, but they don't see any way to make that work with all of their revenue priorities. So yeah, there is a lot of crossover there. I don't think it'll be hard to get to the final deal by the time the session is over. And in terms of the deadline, well, the session has to end no later than April 29th. But if somehow, and this won't happen, but if somehow the budget wasn't finished by then, they'd have to be called back into special session. And really, the deadline is June 30th, when on July 1st of the next day, the state wouldn't have any money.
That makes sense. States need money to operate for sure. Karen, Governor DeWine just signed the Ohio transportation budget. What are the highlights there?
Well, Ohio has four budgets. There is the transportation budget, there's the workers' comp budget, there is the industrial commission budget, and of course, there's the general fund budget, which is being unveiled by Republican House leaders in about 3 minutes. And the transportation budget, it's $11.5 billion over 2 years. It funds various construction projects on interstates and state routes, the Ohio Turnpike. It also includes a couple of things that DeWine was asked to veto that he didn't. One of them is a requirement that people who are registering to vote at the Bureau of Motor Vehicles show proof of citizenship. He had said that he didn't want any more election-related laws, but he signed this and without vetoing that provision. There's also a provision in there that creates a new House leadership position for Phil Plummer, who is the assistant House Speaker pro tem. That was a position that didn't exist before. He's now funded it at just under $100,000, according to the Senate, actually asked for that, not the House. But what's interesting about this is it was not vetoed, and there's at least one analysis I've seen that says the Ohio Constitution doesn't allow a lawmaker for their pay to be changed via law while they're in office. So this is just kind of an interesting little provision that was added into the transportation budget, though it doesn't seem to have a whole lot to do with transportation.
Well, you mentioned, Karen, Ohio has a number of budgets, four budgets. What are the big areas where Ohio lawmakers differ from Governor DeWine's kind of main budget proposal, the one that everybody thinks about as the budget?
Well, that's the one that we're really looking at because, like I said, it's coming out here in a couple of minutes. And Republican House leaders in particular, but also in the Senate, have said, and they're very closely aligned. House and Senate leaders seem to be on the same page on a lot of issues. But they've said very clearly that they don't like Governor Mike DeWine's proposed tax increases on, and this sounds familiar to Indiana, cigarettes. $1.50 per pack increase on cigarettes to fund a child tax credit for kids under six. Also, he's proposed doubling the sports gambling tax on sports gambling operators to fund a specific fund that would do nothing but give out money for sports facilities projects. And then also doubling the marijuana tax. Ohio got legalized marijuana 2 years ago. And so he's said that he wanted to make some changes in that. But Republican leaders have said that they don't like any of these. They may be looking at an income tax cut. We've had income tax cuts in the last seven budgets, so that wouldn't be a huge surprise. But there is some concern about money and where all this is going to come from. And now that the federal COVID one-time money has run out, now the state has some challenges.
Sylvia, this was not a budget year in Kentucky, but Karen just mentioned the income tax in Ohio, and state lawmakers in Kentucky did make changes regarding Kentucky's income tax. Explain what they did, because I'm confused by it.
You would not be alone in that. So yes, similar to what we were just hearing about Ohio, we have had pretty consistent income tax cuts ever since our state legislature set up tax triggers. So it basically, to avoid what they say, what Republican lawmakers will help us avoid a total budget meltdown, is we have to hit certain economic triggers in order to trigger another income tax cut. Well, that's triggered one again this year, so we have another 0.5% cut coming here down the line that was passed this session. But then towards the end of session this year, there's been some concerns that we will not hit a tax trigger every year under the current system. So we had a bill that turned miraculously from a 4-page bill to an 107-page bill in a committee substitute that changes the tax trigger setup to have these tiny incremental cuts. So for the first 2 years, if you hit a certain trigger, you can do a half of what we currently are allowed to, 0.25% cut, so a quarter of a percentage point. And then after that, we allow even smaller increment cuts to 0.1%, 0.2%. So rather than that 0.5%, and that is justified by budget surpluses of twice the amount that they want to cut. So if the budget is of the previous year had a surplus twice of, 0.1% cut, so it was a 0.2% budget surplus, they can cut it by 0.1% moving forward. So they're basically, what they're doing is making it easier to hit some kind of income tax cut trigger in future years, because I think there is some concern within the caucus that that 0.5%, we're going to hit a wall at some point soon where it's going to be hard to hit a full 0.5% trigger cut.
Well, Karen, you mentioned that state lawmakers in Ohio are interested in income tax cuts there, but where does that idea stand and what would that mean? I mean, those taxes pay for things in Ohio. Would cutting the income tax mean reducing or eliminating services?
That's the $10 billion question, because that's how much money the income tax will raise every year in Ohio. And so cutting that entirely, even Speaker Matt Huffman has said that's too dramatic and there may be a look toward moving to a flat tax like 2.75%. But there are a lot of obligations here. And for instance, in this budget proposal, there are questions about Medicaid expansion, which Ohio is funding for about 770,000 people. And there's this proposal proposal that I've done a lot of reporting on, which for sports fans may not sound like a big deal at first, but it could potentially be a big deal. You have the Cleveland Browns, who are planning to move to Brook Park and build Ohio's first domed stadium. And they've asked the state for $600 million in state-backed bonds to fund that project, which would also be funded by local funding as well as by the owners of the Browns, Jimmy and Dee Haslam. And that's been a real point of contention here because some lawmakers, mostly Democrats, but there are a few Republicans who have questions about the money that that project would raise, if it's going to be enough to pay back the state for the debt obligation they would have. It would cost about $1 billion over 30 years for the state to pay back those bonds that they would issue potentially to help the Browns build a stadium. Governor Mike DeWine has said, if that happens, we're going to be bombarded by other professional sports facility requests, like for the Cincinnati Bengals or somebody else. That's why he had proposed this sports facilities fund, which would tax sports gambling operators rather than going to the general fund every time, because he says there's just not enough money to do everything that sports teams want to do.
There are people, prominent people, who are arguing that, hey, Ohio should get rid of the income tax altogether. Isn't that one of the things Vivek Ramaswamy's been saying on the campaign trail?
Yeah, the two leading candidates for governor, Vivek Ramaswamy and Attorney General Dave Yost, have both said they want Ohio to go to zero income tax. But it's been brought up by, for instance, Senator Bill Blessing, who's from the Cincinnati area, that the states that don't have income tax typically have taxes on other things that are much larger. For instance, Alaska and North Dakota and Texas, they have big taxes on pulling natural gas and oil out of the ground, so-called severance taxes. You got other states that do tourism taxes. There would have to be some other way to make up that lost revenue. Again, about $10 billion a year, other than just budget cuts. And when you're also trying to talk about funding sports stadiums and this sort of thing, and some of the sports stadium funding that the Browns put out specifically relies on income taxes to cover that. Well, if income taxes are taxed at a lower rate or there's no income tax, well, what does that do to their overall numbers?
We're talking about regional politics today. If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 513-419-7100, or email talk@wvxu.org. Brandon, let's stick with taxes, but let's shift to property taxes. Indiana lawmakers have been looking at property tax reform there. Where do those efforts stand?
You know, you asked earlier about budget negotiations, and everybody's kind of on the same page, and they're all pretty close, and that'll get done by the end of session. Property taxes, on the other hand, don't feel nearly as settled. I'm sure they will come up with something, but whether or not the governor signs it is another matter entirely. So House and Senate lawmakers, I think, are pretty close here, which is the idea that their top three goals with the major property tax reform this session is, one, make the bills that Hoosiers homeowners pay in 2026 be less than they were in 2025 for the majority of homeowners. The second is making sure that there's some sort of long-term reform of the property tax system to try to eliminate the spikes, the peaks and valleys that you see in assessments and therefore property tax bills. Because that's what's happened the last few years here, as it has happened in many places around the country, which is people's property tax bills, homeowners' bills, were spiking because of a huge rise in home prices. And then the third is making sure that local governments, because the state receives $0 from property taxes, it all goes to local governments and schools, making sure that they still have the tools they need to have the resources they require for the services their constituents sort of depend on. And that looks like it's going to be some sort of giving them more tools to raise local income taxes, for instance. Now, that's what House and Senate Republicans are kind of on the same page about. Mike Braun wants something way more significant. He wants to roll back everybody's property tax bills to 2021 levels, which would blow huge unrecoverable holes in local government and local school budgets. And lawmakers just aren't ready to go there, but Braun keeps on doubling down that he won't accept much less than that. And so I don't know where that's going to head, but there it looks like it's coming down to a showdown that Mike Braun's just not going to win.
Huh. Well, you mentioned local income taxes and how the state lawmakers are saying, hey, these local income taxes could help, you know, fill some of those gaps if property taxes are reduced. But would that kind of kick the football to local governments and municipalities and taxing authorities to, you know, do the unpopular thing and raise those local income taxes?
That is exactly what that is designed to do. State lawmakers don't have to raise your taxes. Local lawmakers have to raise your taxes. And that's been their point, is they feel like the unpopular decision should be on the locals' heads and not on state lawmakers, because that's, I mean, politically, that's the thing you'd want to do, right?
What do Indiana Democrats want to see happen with all this?
The House Democrats just proposed a series of amendments to the bill that are kind of a mixed bag of looking at targeted populations. So looking at the property taxes of homeowners who are age 65 and older, looking at disabled veterans who already get breaks on their property taxes, but increasing those, as well as creating a grant program to provide young first-time home buyers down payment assistance so they can enter the housing market, which has been a huge problem in Indiana, as well as many places in the country. And then they were looking at sort of a homestead credit, an additional homestead credit for homeowners, but they would use it out of the state general fund instead of asking locals to pay for it. That is almost certainly not going to happen, in large part because of what we just talked about with Indiana's budget not having much new money. But it's possible that a part or two of what Democrats are proposing might end up in the final package, because there is some crossover between what Republicans are looking at there in terms of specifically the targeted populations they're trying to help. But spending a bunch of state dollars to help reduce property tax bill just isn't going to happen this year.
Karen Brandon was just talking about how so many Indiana property owners saw their property tax bills spike. Certainly, we've heard a lot about that in Ohio, too. And property tax relief has been a hot topic among state lawmakers in Columbus. Are any legislative proposals gaining traction at the State House when it comes to property tax relief?
Well, property taxes are difficult. They're challenging because when you change one, you change things for so many other areas. I mean, you change that for local school districts and police and fire and libraries and all these things. And so coming up with property tax reform has been a challenge. And there's been a lot of frustration by people who've certainly called their legislators and said, this is unacceptable. But also, there really wasn't anything in Governor Mike DeWine's state of the state or in his state budget that addressed property tax reform. I think he's leaving that primarily to lawmakers to deal with and have them take the heat, essentially. There are a couple of proposals about capping property taxes and finding other ways to in some way reform property tax law, but nothing has really come to the surface as being the big thing, because you've got the question of whether the state should come in and hold harmless the entities that would be hurt if you lowered property taxes, like schools or something like that. So there's a real question about how the state wants to handle that and whether they should just let the locals absorb all that or whether the state can step in and do something.
Sure, because reducing property taxes in some way is going to mean reduced revenue for the services that need those property taxes to function, right?
Absolutely. And so that's a real discussion among Republicans in the supermajority in both the House and the Senate of how is the best way to do that? Is that something the state should take on when, as we were just discussing, there are a lot of obligations that the state is looking at, a lot of bills that have to be paid, but is it really fair to make the local entities have to absorb all that? Ohio is already the leading state in the country for school tax levies, so that could potentially make the problem even worse.
Well, we will be back with our regional politics show after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're in the home stretch of our regional politics show today. My guests are Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith, Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, and Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman. Do you have questions or comments about what's happening in your state capital? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Sylvia, you're now looking in the rearview mirror for this legislative session, and we've talked in the past about transparency concerns that the League of Women Voters of Kentucky has raised about how the Kentucky legislature operates. What did you see in the process this legislative session?
Sure. So, I mean, yes, the League of Women Voters puts out a great report. Now they've done it a couple of years in a row here. But this is something that just as journalists who follow the process very closely, we see on the ground a lot. And so that's what I was really focusing on this year is watching it and chronicling it myself as things happened. And we saw a lot of the same kind of maneuvers that we've seen in years past. And there was a few days in particular where they really became very obvious. You know, I mentioned earlier that that tax cut structure bill, the 775, that bill went from 4 pages to 107 pages overnight. And that happened a couple times with a few different bills this session, where it goes a bill, you know, that was introduced, it maybe had a small technical correction, or maybe it did something significant. But that bill goes through the process. It might even pass a full chamber. And then all of a sudden, in a committee substitute, it has a really significant change in it or another bill slotted in, and it passes that same day or the next day, you know, in really short order. And so that happened a couple times this session with some of the most controversial bills. For example, one bill added several pages, kind of combined several different bills on one of the last, I think it was the last day, actually, before the governor's veto period. So the last day that lawmakers could pass bills before they were to make them veto proof. And in that day, there was a bill that totally would change Medicaid. It required new Medicaid contracts. It required, a lot of oversight, data collection on Medicaid. And also in that very last minute draft, made a mandatory work requirement program in Kentucky, required that the governor, our Democratic governor, request from the Trump administration a change to our state plan to allow us to put in place mandatory work requirements. So that was a pretty last minute change. Literally happened, you know, I think it was at 9:15 p.m. was that committee hearing on that last day before the veto period, with some pretty significant changes in it and the public didn't get to weigh in on.
Right. It makes it real difficult for reporters who are following things to read and digest an extra 100 pages of legislation and things like that.
That too.
I read in your reporting, Sylvia, that some Republican lawmakers are saying, hey, we have to move fast. This is a short 30-day session. We need to get things done. What about that argument and how do people respond to that?
Right. So that is a pretty common argument. They say we have 30 days in these off years. On the on years, we have 60 days, but we also have a budget. There's a lot of things going on. And so they say we got to move fast. Sometimes that means shoving two bills together at the last minute so we can get them moving. They often also make the argument, well, the bill wasn't ready yet, that we had to keep working on it and we put it in front of the public as soon as we could to get a good bill going, to get a good bill through both chambers. And, the argument from transparency advocates like the League of Women Voters is the public input is not something you do because you want to. It's something that you should do and that you need to do if you want to have a transparent legislative process. Lawmakers also tell me that, leadership tell me that this is the way things have always been done. This has been done since Democrats were in power is the argument. And so this is the way we're going to continue to do things so that we can get our priorities through.
We do have a caller on the line. Hey, Robert, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hey, hello. I was listening to the conversation just a few minutes ago about potentially eliminating state taxes, primarily in Ohio. You know, federally, we have the Office of Management and Budget, which will run their own analysis of what that might do to increase the debt, et cetera, over time. Because my concern is when lawmakers are putting forth a proposal, and they're the ones doing their own estimates, it can be pretty self-serving. Does Ohio have any kind of entity that can run the numbers and share with the public what might happen?
Thank you, Robert. Karen, I'm going to let you take that.
Absolutely. And if you're hearing noise in the background, they're doing some drilling here at the State House, which makes me a little nervous, but okay. It's a 150-year-old building. So, but yes, Ohio does have an Office of Budget and Management that does analysis just like that. In fact, they put out monthly estimates on how much the state brings in from all of the different taxes that the state collects. And when there is a bill that is proposed after it has one hearing, there's an analysis done, including a fiscal analysis, by the Legislative Service Commission, which is a nonpartisan office that simply does look at legislation for state lawmakers and tells them what things cost and what the effect of an individual bill would be. So there is nonpartisan review of all these things. And I've specifically asked on the Brown Stadium bond package that we were talking about in the last segment for those numbers, because independent analysis of where estimates come from is incredibly important when you start talking about the kind of money that we're talking about with the budget and a $600 million bond package.
Yeah. Thanks so much for that question, Robert. We appreciate it. Well, Karen, I know the Ohio House changed some of its operating rules early in this session. Democrats criticized those changes as lacking transparency. What have you seen in the House so far? Have you seen any of the stuff that Sylvia was talking about bills growing by 100 pages overnight?
Oh, we've seen that before. I mean, when you have one party in a supermajority, things like that sometimes happen. And we do have a great tool for transparency in Ohio called the Ohio Channel, which is like Ohio C-SPAN, that shows all committee meetings and shows all sessions. It's great for people who want to track legislation. But of course, there are things that happen behind the scenes. It doesn't show conference committees, for instance. Those are the times that you start to see things getting added into budgets and added into bills that don't necessarily track back to one particular lawmaker. So there's always room for improvement in that area. But yeah, there were some rules that were added, not only for public access. You know, you had the public being notified of hearings of bills, that access period, that notification period was shortened, but also there are now, you can't stand outside the House chamber if you are not a state lawmaker or a reporter or a lobbyist. So there are some rules here that have some people very concerned. So far, there hasn't been a terribly wide impact, but there are some activists who are really wondering where this goes next.
Yeah. Brandon, what about in Indiana? It seems like the conversation about transparency has largely centered this session around the Indiana Economic Development Corporation. Explain what's going on there.
Yeah, this is a controversy stemming from a controversial LEAP district. So this is based on the North Carolina's Triangle Park, where the state has bought up hundreds of acres of land and prepped it to get ready for companies that might potentially want to move here. But of course, if they end up not moving here, then the state is out a lot of money with no real return on that investment. Now, so far, the only company that's publicly moved there is Eli Lilly, which is already headquartered in Indiana, expanding a facility into this LEAP district. There's potentially Meta moving in there as well, with a data center or something like it, but we'll see what else comes out of it. And the IEDC is a quasi-public agency, so they're exempt from a lot of public disclosure laws, and lawmakers have been saying, hey, you're spending all this money without, in their minds, a lot of oversight. But legislative leaders have been fairly resistant to too much oversight on the IEDC, saying the agency is already transparent enough. There is a bill that would require the IEDC to notify the county and city if they're going to buy 100 acres of land or more, things like that. There's a new oversight on major water transfers, which was the major issue with the LEAP district, but they haven't gone much further than that in more oversight at IEDC because, as Republican leaders say, there's already enough.
Well, Brandon, have you heard any concerns about the legislative process in Indiana, like what we've just heard about in Kentucky and Ohio? Certainly there's a strong Republican supermajority there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of the same issues always come up, which is major language being dropped into a bill in committee or on the floor after the public has had a chance to testify on it. It's not uncommon. The most common, actually, really concerning one is you can put any language you want in the state budget. And so by the time we get close to the end of April, I wouldn't be surprised, because it's happened plenty of times before, if suddenly when the final budget draft comes out, the language that lawmakers will vote on, there's just language added to the end of it on any random thing that lawmakers decided to do at the end of session with no testimony, no discussion, no debate That happens not infrequently.
Well, what, Brandon, what about in Indiana? Is there some kind of public, you know, Indiana version of C-SPAN like Karen referenced in Ohio, if folks want to watch the kind of how the sausage gets made with committee meetings and that sort of thing?
Every public committee hearing, every public floor session of the House and Senate are all streamed on the Indiana legislature's website, which is iga.in.gov. That is always, and you can go and watch the recordings of every single one of those hearings and floor sessions from this session, from past sessions. I will say Indiana has for a long time done a good job of making all of those really easy to watch.
And how about in Kentucky, Sylvia? Is there a similar resource in Kentucky?
We do. We have KET, which they record almost every committee hearing and every floor session, and also the Legislative Research Commission, which is our version of a nonpartisan research group. They do. They stream on YouTube all of the committee hearings, so those are also available in kind of two different places.
Okay. Well, those are handy resources. Just quick question for each of you at the very end here. Brandon, you mentioned that there's a lot coming up with the budget. What's the big thing you're going to be watching for in the next week or so?
We'll see the Senate budget plan as well as the House Republican property tax proposal. Those are the two biggest things I'm looking for in the next week.
Okay. How about you, Karen? What are your eyes on the budget plan that's being released today, I bet?
Absolutely. And it sounds like that $600 million bond package, again, that would cost the state $1 billion over 30 years and doesn't have independently verified numbers yet. That's in the budget. So we are going to be watching that one along with school funding and vouchers and property tax and all that stuff.
Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media, State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman, and Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Thank you all so much for your time today. You should check out all their reporting on our website, WVXU.org. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.